car and a boat now. Things got bad, now the boat won't float, I don't like it. I'm too proud to be poor. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working. We're not a working. We're just not working anymore. They used to call us working class, but we're just
hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you by listener-supported community radio station WEFT, broadcasting in downtown from downtown Champaign, Illinois at 90.1 FM and live worldwide at WEFT.org. Views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
The Campus Faculty Association at the University of Illinois advocates for academic freedom, shared governance, and a strong faculty voice on campus. CFA is proud to support community radio and the Labor Hour in support of strong unions. You can learn more about the CFA by visiting cfaillinois.org. The hour programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union groups and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, guests. We're going to be having some guests call in at half past the hour from Shyampa Radio out of Tampa, and it's going to be kind of an interesting program with them. Bill, you have something to
Dave,
comment.
That's Shyampa!
Okay, thank you for that. All right. So, in the meantime, though, we're going to be talking about some news headlines. And, Gus, what's been happening this week?
Oh, it's that time. I want to save the big victory for the NTFC for the end of the show. If
okay,
that's fine.
Sure.
And let's go into some more, national news.
Mm-hmm.
It's time for our monthly update for the jobs report. The jobs report was released yesterday. And for the first time, the federal government is not celebrating the jobs report because they have found out the things that we've been talking about on this show for the past few months are finally coming to fruition, that the job growth is not only stagnated, but wages are continuing to fall and a lot of sectors are starting massive layoffs. So the U.S. economy continued to stagnate in April, creating a mere 160,000 jobs, far fewer than the 200,000 predicted by economists and the lowest number in 7 months, according to the monthly employment report released by the Labor Department. Employment gains have averaged 192,000 a month so far this year, well below 2015's average of 229,000 jobs a month. And the official unemployment rate edged up to 5.0% from 4.9%, and employment fell by the most since 2013. The labor force actually declined, with 362,000 people dropping out of the labor market. The labor participation rate, and those that know me know I love my data, the share of working age people in the labor force dropped to 62.8% from the previous month's 63%. So the employment to population ratio also is declining and fell to 59.7%. So again, these are all numbers they look like small increments that of decline, but this is what led to the big recession in 2007. So these dismal figures are consistent with recent data and the stuff that we talk about in the World Labor Hour, showing a sharp deceleration in U.S. economic growth, which is slow for three consecutive quarters. Last week, the government reported that the nation's GDP rose by only 0.5% in the first 3 months of 2016. That's the weakest quarterly pace in 2 years. Of particular significance was a dramatic decline in business investment, portending more months of minimum job growth. And we all remember, any time in American history, whenever business investment stops, then job growth not only stagnates, but regresses as layoffs have been going on all over the place. So, just to talk a little bit about the layoffs and just give, some more data on that. On Thursday, the outplacement consultancy firm Challenger Gray and Christmas reported a sharp increase in layoff announcements by U.S.-based companies in April. Challenger said that employers had given notification of workforce reductions totaling 65,141 jobs, which is a 35% increase over March and nearly 6% higher than the number recorded in April of 2015. So as of right now, in the first 4 months of 2016, U.S. employers have announced more than 250,000 job cuts, at 24% higher than the same period a year ago, and the highest January-April total since the worst point of the economic crisis of 2009.
Wow. Now, these figures are seasonally adjusted, I take it?
Of course.
Okay, yeah.
And the thing about it is that, you know, It's at the point now to where even the federal government can't hide what's happening to the economic base in the country now. Mm-hmm. Now even their figures are starting to show really bad cracks that are leading to a possible, not possible, but imminent recession that's coming at the end of this year. Yeah.
And we never have really fully recovered from the one, you know, recession of 2007, 2008.
Yeah. And I don't think we ever will.
Yeah, it's really, you're really bumming me out, man.
Well. Every month when I do this jobs report, it's never going to be a very happy story when I do this every month. So when we do it in the beginning of June, it's probably going to be much worse. I mean, that's just the way capital is so volatile that you're going to have these lows and highs. And we had a high in 2013, 2014, but now the low started in the middle of 2015 and going into this year now. And that's just the way that the system operates.
Yeah, especially in this late stage of capitalism,
exactly.
You know, where it's becoming basically almost cannibalistic, you know.
Yeah, that's an excellent adjective to describe it. Yeah.
Okay. All right, just some quick things, some short headlines about what's been going on around the country. I guess Thursday was a National Day of Action in solidarity with the Verizon strike, now entering its fourth week.
Yes.
39,000 communication workers and IBEW electrical workers are striking to get a fair new labor contract, while the highly profitable company Verizon had $39 billion in profits over the last 3 years. $39 billion in profits over the last 3 years, and they say they can't afford to, and it's mainly over health insurance, from what I understand. And also, I guess, American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten said three bills forced through the Michigan House by Republicans are some of the most despicable anti-student, anti-public school, anti-teacher provisions we've seen in America. And tens of thousands of people marched and rallied to defend public schools in 80 cities across the country. May 4th was a National Day of Action to Reclaim Public Schools. The Alliance to Reclaim Our Schools, consisting of more than 100 community and labor organizations, organized the days of rallies, marches, and walk-ins for schools all our children deserve. It's a movement to defend public schools against corporate privatization, attacks on teachers' union, and just the erosion in general of public education. I guess in Chicago, workers are filing a class action lawsuit against 16 Dunkin' Donuts store franchises in downtown Chicago. Mm-hmm. And the suit was announced Wednesday. The suit alleges wage theft and unsafe conditions at the store. Wow.
Yeah.
In Detroit, teachers did a sick out on Monday and closed 94 of the city's 97 public schools. Detroit Federation of Teachers Ivy Bailey says that the 1,500 teachers learned they might not be paid after this month. And I guess also with the Verizon strike, they, a lot of the Verizon strikers think that it's really an attempt for union busting by Verizon.
Oh, yeah.
We'll have to see how that pans out. And then also here in Chicago, I guess fast food workers rallied in the Chicago suburb of Oak Park Monday, demanding a $15 an hour living wage ordinance.
Excellent.
And workers rallied and planned a march to the Village Hall meeting to request the ordinance. And then some quick news stories you might want to go into more detail from. In These Times. Thank you. Okay, In These Times. These stories that just are on the new issue that's online is how can the fight for 15 move from winning wage increases to winning a union? Also, garment factory workers in Southern California are calling for a boycott of American Apparel. And also, as Verizon strike enters its fourth week, local unions take the lead in solidarity. And last but not least, reformers aim to shake up the New York City Teachers Union. I guess there's a rank and file movement trying to take to get control of the leadership, very needed and stuff.
Yes.
And I have to say, there was that rally for the non-tenured faculty union. It was a couple of weeks ago in front of the administration building. I guess somebody from the Illinois Federation of Teachers came and spoke and was warmly talking about Al Shanker. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with that guy. Was a former president, national president of the American Federation of Teachers. Bill, do you remember him?
He was the name is definitely familiar.
Most right-wing reactionary, and he talked glowingly about it. I got about ready to throw up, you know. This guy, I mean, back when the Central American stuff was going on with Reagan and them, I mean, he was actually defending Ronald Reagan for sending military aid to the murderous dictatorships of Guatemala and El Salvador, you know. And, I mean, this guy was a real piece of work. I mean, you know, the only thing that kept him in power so long was he did get good contracts for his teachers, you know. So, but otherwise, geez, I mean, you know, you know, we need to talk about this because, you know, this is part of, you know, the union movement here is that, you know, we need, what we need for this country for the future is a strong democratic rank and file controlled unions that are also very, class conscious and militant. I mean, because, you know, this business unionism is just running us into the ground. I mean, it's just, it's not working. It hasn't been working. Never has, actually.
Well, I'm thinking what's going on now is just, I mean, when we talk about at the end of the show, the NTFC victory and what their militancy did, and also what's going on with Verizon. And I have another story, if we have time for it, to talk about the Alabama inmates who went on strike.
Oh, yes, indeed.
I mean, so what you have going on here is that there is a bit of, and I'm not trying to make hyperbole, but there are instances of worker militancy that we haven't seen in a while that may be spreading and expanding.
Yes, let's hope so.
So yeah, right now it's isolated, so it's not a movement yet.
Mm-hmm.
But if this continues through 2016 and we have more strikes and more labor militancy, then we could be in our way for a movement by 2017 of rank and file workers actually take control of their unions and the labor movement itself and not letting it be controlled by these corporate elite leaders for like Dennis Williams, you know, like they're going to take the movement away from them.
Indeed.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing is that what's really interesting is this, these strikes in the prisons. I mean, which have been all over the place, California, Texas. I mean, you know,
Menard, I believe.
And Menard here in Illinois. Okay.
Yeah. And you know who's working on that? Who's representing those people, or at least was?
Representing which people?
The strikers.
All the strikers? No. Who?
Stoughton Lind.
Oh yeah,
lawyer and
yes.
Labor historian
out of out of
Ohio or Pennsylvania.
It's Ohio near Penn. It's near Pittsburgh.
Yeah, let me look this. I'll do some research.
Yeah, okay. And Angela, you had a real interesting story you wanted to share with the listeners. I think that's probably you know, I think a lot of listeners probably could relate to.
Oh yeah, well yeah. My daughter, you know, she works and she's working hard. She has two kids. She has her own place. She's being charged a lot for child care, you know. And she, you know, she used to leave them there till like 5:30. But now she has to go pick them up when she gets off her job at 1:30 because she says she can't afford it.
Oh, man.
So she's barely, you know, making enough to live. And then they want to charge you all this daycare charges. And then on top of that, they want to cut off the link card as well. As long as you make a couple of dollars, they want to cut off your link card.
Yeah, and what's your daughter do for a living?
She goes to houses and takes care of older people.
Home health care provider?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, she's doing her best, but it's like the better you do, the more they try to cut you down.
Yeah.
Well, you know, especially with daycare and the cost of that, you know, that's something that a lot of grassroots organizations have been attempting to move forward on and trying to get these elected officials to do something about some type of federal subsidy or something to curb the cost of daycare, because daycare is incredibly expensive, and in this working environment, this sub working class environment, it's virtually impossible to have somebody to pay for child care unless you have some type of assistance with it.
Oh yeah, so it's like, okay, she got to feed her kids, and then the people that take care of her kids has to feed their kids as well.
Indeed.
So, you know, it's just an ongoing struggle. And another thing I wanted to say as well is, I have a friend also, and she, you know, was just going through a hard time about her grandchildren. They were taken from her because somebody called and said, okay, well, she's smoking marijuana. Okay, well, they're going to make it legal anyway.
Eventually,
long as it's not right there and the child is not in right there with this person, then I feel like they don't have nothing to say about that, because you need something for these kids these days. You can't whoop them, you know what I'm saying? So you gotta have something to stimulate your mind. But I feel like long as these kids are fed, taken care of, and everybody that knows her knows she does a good job with them. So they were recently taken for some accusation somebody called, but you know, they take these kids out of the homes with the people that love them and then put them in a home with a stranger. And you don't know what these people are doing to these kids these days.
Yeah.
So I feel like they need to kind of compromise on that, because you're taking them from the people that really care for them. Now they got to be away from their families.
That's the thing, is first of all, it's an accusation. Second of all, I mean, if the kids were being taken care of, I mean, so what? I mean, you know,
right,
if that's the way if that's how she has to cope, you know, with
you know,
life stresses and takes care of the kids.
Job. Yeah. She works from like 7, 8 in the morning to like 4.
Mm-hmm.
So after you get off work, you want to unwind and, you know, maybe have you a little something, but I don't feel like there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But what they need to do is compromise on that and just, you know, work with the people on this, because you can't just take kids out of home. Then that's where they call that broken home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then now the child feels some way about the mom. Now there's a problem. Then that's why they have issues growing up. Now they're getting in trouble because they've been taken away from their parents, you know, but, you know, it's just unfair to me.
Yeah, indeed. You know, in most Western European countries, child care is free. Daycare is free. It's paid through for your taxes, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, gee, what a concept, huh? I mean,
I know, and look at those countries, though, you know, similar. I mean, and we're doing way better.
Well, we are a richer economy. It's just that we are, you know, it's not the incomes, you know, is not, you know, it's very unfair, unequal distribution of income, you know, and what money is raised through the taxes is spent on, you know, these wars of military aggression, tax breaks to the wealthy, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
It doesn't have anything to do with us.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, you know, it's anyway, yeah.
It's an ongoing struggle.
There's so much we lack in this country. I mean, as a richest country as we are, I mean, the average working person is starting to fall back into, I mean, almost we're getting almost the point of third world standards here.
Oh, okay.
You know, I mean, our infant mortality rates and our life expectancy, more than Cuba. You know, I mean, that's what's crazy. Cuba's life expectancy now, just as of last year, is 1 year longer than here in the United States. And if you compare us to Canada and Europe, we're like anywhere from, 3 to 5 years, you know, behind. So, I mean, it's like, you know, this all takes a toll. These policies of neoliberalism is just, you know, it's driving us down further and further.
Well, I heard it's going to get worse before it gets better.
I think so.
But you know what? I'm glad to hear that there's a lot of strikes going on. There's a lot of things being put in place to try to change all this. And like Gus said, hopefully by 2017, we'll have a lot of, you know.
Come the revolution.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Dave, something I was thinking about is I think that we really just need to rethink the whole idea of family.
Mm-hmm.
And we're families and individuals and communities intersect.
Mm-hmm.
And we should take a lot of the burden off of the family by communitizing the raising of children.
That would help for sure.
You know, I mean, I would even look, go so far as to look at, the book, The Dispossessed by, Ursula K. Le Guin.
Uh-huh.
Okay, which is a description of an anarchist society,
mm-hmm,
in one part that is suffering under really bad conditions because they lost the revolution and got exiled to a really bad planet.
Mm-hmm.
But she somewhat has a little bit of a critique of it, but it does describe how family is. In that situation, the children weren't even generally aware of who their parents were.
Oh, that's interesting concept.
Also, too, there's another one too. A very famous anthropologist, Carol Stack. I've mentioned her book on here before. All Our Kin,
mm-hmm,
which I consider to be really the foundational work in looking at network kinships and community, like Bill said, the community taking care of the children, raising each other. You know, and it's a very powerful book. And she did this by actually living with the community that was working poor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, they literally had to share food, money, everything to get around. And people didn't know this at the time when she did this, but the city issues a suit on them for it. But it was actually right here in Champaign.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
wow,
so,
interesting.
Yeah, she did her research here and did all that.
Yeah, so the conditions for that. I mean, the thing is, this society just encourages individualism, alienation, either be afraid of your neighbor or, try to outdo your neighbor. And, you know, this is all the forces, I mean, these cultural forces that are subtly, through the media or whatever, preventing things like that. You know, I think you're right that this, you know, we talk about wanting to have a revolutionist country, that there's many facets of it, you know, and that's one of them, of course, you know, that I think is very important. That could be a whole program actually sometime in the future.
A program on alienation and community. Yeah, that'd be fun.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know, has anybody ever read, I believe Engels wrote a book on the family. Mark Sandhagen,
the history
the
of the
family.
I started reading that. I read about 50-60 pages of it. It was interesting. Yeah,
and then your eyes glazed over.
Well, yeah, I just got distracted by other things. But no, it's it was interesting. The fact that you know, we all started out from pretty much matriarchal societies. You know, where the women were the ones that were basically in charge of. It was an equal, more equal society where men and women each had an equal role in things. Women a lot of times were the administrators, the caregivers, and the men were more the hunters and gatherers kind of thing, and warriors. But there was an equality there. There was a, you know, equal share of the responsibility and the power, if you will. You know, it kind of went into that. It was talking about this is more the nature of human nature in general, and it was only this patriarchal stuff that came later.
And
you know,
that was the thing too, and that one of the things that they emphasize and that you see that we always talk about. Is that, you know, I think Bill brought up a really important point in this idea of understanding what family meant and what family should mean, and that to go outside of this idea of blood,
mm-hmm.
that it shouldn't be solely a blood relationship, and family is something that when you call somebody family, like you mean it. Like, you know, right. That's one of the things, particularly with African Americans after emancipation period, because, you know, marriages were illegal. And of course, you know, children were taken away from sharecropping, and it was difficult to actually have blood families. Then, you know, you had to actually, the people in your community were your family. Like it was like, true. Even though we weren't blood, it was just right.
We grew up together. We work with each other.
There's always been a different type of cultural aspect in terms of African Americans and non-Westernized countries of what a family is. So the way the family works here is nuclear idea. That's a very Westernized sense, a new type of family formation. Mm-hmm. We need to get away from that.
God, let's do a whole program on this sometime. This is, I think,
and also too, I think it's also a real basis of fascism, especially when you're talking about the blood thing, and then that can be
extended way beyond
for race and national life. Exactly. You know.
Yeah. Good point, Bill. Okay, we're going to take a quick music break. Music I'm going to be playing today is in honor of the victory with the non-tenured faculty union. So this first one we play is Bob Marley, Get Up, Stand Up. So we'll be right back. You listen to the World Labor Hour and listen to Support Community Radio Station WFT Champaign 90.1 FM.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that Peter scrolled after story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on,
get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Good morning. This is Anthony with Cheyenne Pa Radio.
Hi, Anthony. David Johnson here, and I'm here with our hosts, Bill Gorell, Gus Wood, and Angelo Bingham.
Yeah. I'm a long-time listener, and you're a first-time caller.
Okay.
Oh, wonderful. Glad to hear that.
Okay, well, you know, frankly, let's just start off. Why don't you just introduce yourself to listeners
and what you do. No problem.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I'm Anthony. I run a internet radio station along with a good friend of mine, Joe. He's up in Chicago, hence why we call our station Cheyenne Pa Radio. It's an amalgamation of Chicago and Tampa. And we generally we promote a lot of either independent music or other community radio stations, such as yourself, World Labor Hour, we carry on the weekends. And we also do our own show throughout the, or actually on Monday nights, we do, the Joe and Anthony show. And, we promote the safe and responsible use of marijuana.
Okay. Yeah. You know, I tell you what, a lot of people might be surprised, you know, why we'd want to have you call in today. But, I think, you know, in general, I kind of wanted the listeners to know about, how you guys ended up, doing you know, the internet, radio that you do and what kind of motivated you to start the show and in particular focusing on, you know, that topic. You know, we've talked a lot about, the whole issue of marijuana legalization, not to mention, you know, the whole, you know, prison industrial complex. I mean, and recently we had a guest on who was going to be opening up a you know, medical marijuana dispensary here in Champaign-Urbana sometime soon because the law was just passed in Illinois recently allowing that. So, you know, we come back to this topic, we seem like, quite a bit. So, and not to mention that we're flattered to hear that you like our program and, you know, encourage other people to listen to it. But why don't you, I don't know where you want to start on this. Do you want to talk about maybe what motivated you guys to start your program?
Yeah, actually, it's kind of funny how it all started, because back in 2007, I had lived in Chicago, and my job had transferred me down here to Tampa, Florida. And my good friend Joe, who runs the station with me, we wound up finding ourselves talking on the phone very often throughout the evenings, and of course, enjoying our recreational use of marijuana. And we've kind of started to realize that we were kind of interesting within ourselves. And yeah, so we got together and we started doing a podcast. And we said, well, you know, there's got to be more that we can do, kind of get some stuff out there. And I'm a bit of a tinkerer, so I always like to do things with a computer. I work in IT. So we said, well, let's make this radio station. So initially our format was we went out and we found a lot of local bands, because clearly we couldn't pay for the licensing fees required for copyright. So we found a lot of local bands that wanted to have their music promoted. So
and that's in Tampa? Is that down in Tampa?
In Tampa.
Okay.
Well, yeah. Well, actually, I'm in Tampa. He's still in Chicago.
Okay.
But we found bands both in Chicago and in Tampa.
Oh, okay. Cool.
To promote.
Okay.
And the station server's in Tampa, but yeah, we it's kind of a joint venture.
Okay.
So we started doing that, and of course, we carved out a time slot for us to get on and do our podcast live. And that actually went well for almost a year, year and a half. And then, unfortunately, the economic collapse really kind of put us behind for a while. And just past last year, I want to say it was May of last year, so I think we're coming on a year now again, we were talking one day, and we're like, you know, running that station was a good thing, and we like doing our show, and the movement of recreational marijuana seems to have been picking up a lot more steam lately. So we said, well, why don't we go out and let's do this again? You know, I still had the software, which cost an arm and a leg, and I said, well, let's put it together. So we went ahead, and this time, instead of finding the local bands, we said, well, you know what, there's got to be other, you know, there's other podcasts out there and other shows that really fit into what we believe and what we like to promote. So we started going out and picking up different shows, and we put together a schedule format on the internet radio station. And on top of that, we do our show Monday nights live, 7:30 Eastern. And we go for about an hour and a half. We found that after that, we kind of go into tangents way too far for most people to understand.
Okay.
We understand.
So we do that, and then, you know, as I said, we seek out new things that we can promote, and we run a morning slot, which we call Morning Rush Hour, and we basically go out and scour the internet for just about anything we can find, and we give it in 15-minute increments throughout the morning to kind of keep your drive fresh.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's really interesting. So the major, I guess, cost involved is the software for an internet radio station?
Yeah, it's the software and, of course, obviously the internet connection and mm-hmm. all the electricity that it takes. It can put up a hefty power bill, especially in Florida where our rates aren't cheap.
Okay.
But yeah, there's a lot of different hosting sites out there. We use a free hosting service, which gives us a lot of limitations sometimes in terms of where we can put our stream. But it has helped us for now. And as we progress, we look at definitely upgrading equipment and our providers and such.
Okay. Can I ask you what the cost is to, let's say, when you first started out on this? I mean,
oh, yeah,
everything.
Sure. Uh-huh. Sure, not a problem, not a problem. Well, obviously, your regular internet connection. I'm lucky enough to have fiber where I'm at, so that runs me about $100 a month.
Mm-hmm.
The software, I bought that a while ago, but I want to say it was close to $350.
Okay.
Unfortunately, it's really one of the very few out there, and it's not the best, so there's a lot of frustration involved that doesn't have a price tag on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, any computer equipment and such like that, which, you know, if most people, if you already have a computer, you're ready to go.
Okay.
I bought a mixer and a microphone for the studio myself. So, you know, that sets you back a couple more $100.
Mm-hmm.
But in total, to get started, you could really do it for under $1,000.
Under $1,000?
Even cheaper. Yeah. And even cheaper, especially if you're going the podcast route, because you don't have to have the broadcast server, which is generally the most expensive part mm-hmm. of the whole setup.
Yeah, I gotta say, your show sounds really good.
We it's taken years of practice.
Yeah.
Actually, mm-hmm. in high school, I used to do my high school, and I don't think they do anymore, but we used to have a community radio station out of the high school, and I actually got my senior year, I got a time slot that I was able to do, and which kind of helped me through to tweak things in that aspect.
Okay. You know, that sounded really interesting though about, you know, when you guys in both Chicago and Tampa were getting, local, bands to come on and stuff. I mean, you know, cause we've talked before about the whole corporatization of the music industry out there and how, you know, it's difficult to hear, you know, new music. I mean, even with all the technology and the internet and YouTube and all that, you know, you turn on the average radio and all you hear is this corporate crap, you know, regardless of what musical genre it is, you know. And that's really neat. I mean, it's too bad you guys don't do that a little bit once in a while still.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, that in of itself is what was a full-time job.
I bet it was a lot of time, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, because a lot of times you got to chase down the bands, and then there's a lot of times you have to deal with a lot of legal work as well to say, well, look, if we play your stuff, we don't want you coming back and suing us later on for
mm-hmm.
royalties.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what we found though is a lot of these community radio stations that we pick up throughout the country, and actually I think we pick a couple feeds up in Canada, they also brought kind of broadcast a lot of the off-label, local artists.
Okay.
And a lot of college. I think one of the ones we pick up is a college station, and they do a lot of local stuff as well throughout the country from different states. So we definitely do get some of that out there, but I do agree with you, and that was another driving point on us, because most broadcast stations, and even now your internet radio stations, your Spotify's, your Pandora's, a lot of those, you're just going to get whatever's coming out of the major record labels.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to find that independent music is really tough, and it's becoming harder and harder, I've noticed over the years.
I thought it was just my age. I mean, I'll be 59 in July, but I've heard other people younger than me say the same thing.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's out there on the internet, but it's not accessible. It's very difficult to locate it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, by the way, I want to mention to our listeners, and perhaps if you weren't aware of it, Anthony, we do have a local music show live in what we call the Great Hall here on Monday evenings. I believe, when does that start? 8 or 9 o'clock?
I think it's 8, yeah.
Okay.
Central time, yeah.
And then after that show is another show called Local 901, which is recordings of local bands. And that's also on the YouTube channel too. I believe that's the Urbana Public TV YouTube channel. So we're bringing some local music. And how's Betty doing today?
Betty sleeps on the weekends. We don't let her out of her crate on the weekends. She causes enough havoc throughout the week.
And who's Betty?
We, in our great state of alteredness, we've created personalities at the radio station. And initially, we were just using text-to-speech to do various bump station IDs, stuff like that. And then eventually, one day, we're like, you know what? We can make a personality out of this. And Betty is our robotic personality. She's actually the one that runs the weekday rush hour in the mornings. And it's definitely sometimes a comedy routine within of itself.
Okay.
I think she's going to pass the Turing test soon. Maybe.
I think so. I think so. She's been getting smarter. She's going to put me out of a job soon.
Bill, I think it's great that you've been listening. We got to maybe promote their show a little bit, you know, because I think this is really, this is just fascinating. I mean, you guys, you know, taking this time and effort to do this, you know. Let me ask you something. You know, the main topic of your program is, you know, the recreational use of marijuana.
Well, there's a lot else on there, too.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that was really kind of funny. Yeah, okay. What I was getting to is where do you see in the next year or two this country going as far as, you know, more, you know, as far as recreational marijuana legalization, if you will, decriminalization?
Well, I think, you know, right now what we're looking at, I believe, four states now, Colorado, Washington, Oregon, and Alaska. And I think in and of itself, that is going to be the big litmus test on how the rest of the country is going to react.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know recently in Illinois, you guys just saw legalized marijuana for
and it was a battle, too. Yeah, it was a real battle.
It's very restricted also. I'm sure Joe let you
know that. That's exactly. We've heard pretty much you have to be pretty far gone in the stage of life to be able to even qualify for it. And in Florida, we actually tried to put it on an amendment ballot last election cycle, and we actually got a 59% vote on it.
Wow.
But it needed 60% to pass.
Oh.
So yeah, it was so close.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe they're trying to put it back on to the amendment again this election cycle. There's been some hemming and hawing about it, but it was definitely very popular. Afterwards, the state legislator had said that they would work on it and try to deliver because obviously the populace wanted it. But I do come from the great state where we deal with some pretty bad politicians, and they just totally ignored it. Altogether, especially Rick Scott. He's obviously been making some headlines as well lately. But in terms of how the rest of the country is going to see it, I think it's going to start gaining more popularity. And I honestly think it's not necessarily the fact that, you know, we have it in four states and it's not this dangerous drug that we've been led to believe through the promotion of Reefer Madness and prison complex and such like that. But I think what's actually going to wind up happening is there's going to be this realization that there's a lot of tax revenue
mm-hmm.
that they see on the recreational use of marijuana. And, you know, obviously many states, and especially I know Illinois, you guys are really battling some budget shortfalls.
Oh, yes.
And, oh, yeah. And I definitely think that eventually people are going to see these four states and say, you know what? This really hasn't caused any more issues. People aren't running around in the street. There's not anarchy and mass chaos. And you know, maybe this is something we should look at. But I think really the key pivotal part is the federal level of it and how it's currently classified is going to really push. I think once the federal level says, you know what, we need to declassify this, we're going to see a lot more states following suit with that.
Yeah. What states are coming up? Are there any states that are going to be voting on any time some here in 2016 do you know of?
Not other than I believe Florida again. I'm not aware.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe Indiana. I think there. Have heard something about that, but
yeah.
I could be wrong. Could be wrong. I haven't actually looked at that recently. Joe actually would know more about that, and unfortunately, he's not with us today. So, but yeah, I'm not exactly sure who's going to be doing it next. But I wouldn't be surprised if there's a few that we're going to see coming out again this election cycle.
And
by the way,
Dave,
bring up that Paul Muth messaged me and said that West sessions begin at 10 p.m.
Oh, 10 p.m. East Central.
Yeah, that's Central time. And then local 901 is at 11.
11 Central. 10 Central and 11 Central. Okay, that's good. What time is your show on again?
We run at 7:30 Eastern.
Okay.
In the evening.
Okay. And so how would somebody access your program if they want to tune in and listen?
Yeah, sure. If anyone want to listen in, they can just go to our webpage. It's chiampa.info, chiampa.info. And we actually have a link right at the top of the page to listen live, and that will take you. And we offer actually two different streams. We offer a high-quality and a lower-quality stream. So if you're on a mobile device and don't want to eat up all your data, you can go with the lower stream.
Okay.
I just want to say I've been downloading the show well, for about a year now. I've missed a few episodes. I get it at radioforall.net, And I'm glad to hear you guys promoting Radio for All quite a bit on your show. And I want to tell you, I was thrilled a few weeks ago. I was on a job and I had a hard time. It's not a very good listening situation. And I heard you guys start talking about this labor show. And, you know, and it turns out it was ours. And I was just thrilled to death.
Oh yeah, we love your show. I mean, I come from the telecom industry before I was laid off, and I've actually dealt a lot with the unions, and I've seen how a lot of it is going on internally, and of course now we see this Verizon strike going on right now. So, I mean, for both of us, actually, and Joe used to work in the financial industry.
Really?
So he saw, he was kind of affected by the whole recession as well. And, you know, we both have seen a lot of how these companies have worked internally. And we realize, you know, that there's definitely a war against the common worker. And it's really terrible and it's really hurting us.
You know, that's really powerful considering two people are former, quote unquote, insiders, if you will, seeing us, you know, realizing this and everything. And because, you know, I think this is one of the big things is people's awareness that, you know, it's like, it is a war on working people. I mean, it definitely is.
We might have to pull that song out by
Anfini, yes.
And by the way, I believe what Joe, is he a waiter now?
He actually, he manages, Orange Restaurant in Chicago.
Okay.
Yeah, so, and that's why obviously weekends in the food service industry doesn't give you much time off.
That's correct. And you said you're working in IT now then, right?
Yeah. Yes, I do. I do IT, network support.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, thank you so much, for calling in today and everything, and, look forward to, cross promoting each other's shows, because I'll tell you what, the internet, I think, has a huge potential for, you know, change for the better, and it's going to be shows like yours, ours, and other people out there to create their own shows, you know, and, I think this is the wave of the future, and it sounds like you guys are definitely, on the cutting edge of that.
Oh, by the way, Anthony, I don't get high at work all the time. But when I do, I listen to Chiampa.
Okay.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for having me on this evening, guys.
Oh, you bet. Thank you. Take care. Okay. All right. So that was Anthony from Chiampa Radio, and we're going to play some quick music, and we'll be right back. And, again, you're listening to the World Labor on the Supporting Community Station, WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned. Okay, that was Patti Smith. People have the power, and the non-tenured faculty union are aware of that, aren't they, Gus?
That's right. There is no better sense of power in the state of Illinois than what happened in Champaign County with the non-tenured track faculty, Local 6546. Definitely give a big shout out to the bargaining committee lead negotiator Kay, who we had on the show before. Also, the strike committee chairperson, Christina, and also yes. the president of NTFC, Sean. You know, they for those that are unaware, NTFC initiated two major strike episodes in the past couple of weeks that led to them getting a very lucrative contract for the working the non-tenure track faculty workers on the campus of the University of Illinois. Now I have the provisions here of what the contract looks like and why it was such a powerful thing for them to do, because they tried negotiating this contract to be fair for over almost two years
yes.
now. And it wasn't until the middle of Friday afternoon to the end of Saturday night that they got all of the contract done after the strike periods. So the labor militancy worked.
They should have done it probably a lot sooner, but, you know, live and learn.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, that's always one of the hardest things to get to, is get to that point to where you want to shut down and you want to, withhold your labor. It's a very hard decision. And they have many, many battles about it, just like any other union, like what's going on Verizon. I'm sure they had weeks of debate on when to initiate a strike authorization.
And then they probably didn't even want to go that far, but they're not getting any. No feedback, so.
Or any progress. I mean, I heard some of these U of I administrators were like, being rude and I guess, walking out of the meetings and slamming doors. I mean, just childish, you know, behavior.
They did many things that I can't repeat on air.
Oh, really? Okay.
I was in the bargaining room a few times and there's been, it's clear that there was an egotism that was just rampant about we're better than you are. And, not only do we not understand what, teachers and professors need to teach their courses, but we don't care because it doesn't register with our interests.
Mm-hmm.
And that was always clear from the get-go. And that's why anytime you sit and negotiate a labor contract, there's never going to be a full contract unless you can show people power.
Yeah.
That's the only way, because their interests are never going to be in the employer's interests are never in the interests of the employee.
Yeah.
And unless you show that you can take your labor away or you can do something to damage the employer's interests, that's when negotiations can occur.
Yeah.
And that's a historical trend. And anybody that doesn't believe that is lying to themselves.
Right.
I'm just being honest.
There's a famous quote from, of all people, George Shultz, who used to be, was it Ronald Reagan's Secretary of State, where he said, negotiations is merely a euphemism for, basic conciliation, unless there's the shadow of power behind it.
Yeah.
You know, basically saying, if you don't have something to back up, you know, your, what you want to do, then you're not negotiating. If you don't have some power to back it up with, you know.
Exactly. And the NTFC had the power. They organized themselves perfectly, and then they developed relationships with multiple groups, multiple unions on campus and in the community, different groups, and they organized them as well. See, they didn't try to just mobilize people and just like, hey, you know, we got this going on, will you support us? No, NTFC developed relationships, meaning they organized people and went through and actually had conversations and went to meetings and always supported what other groups were doing. You know, when we were attacked as Black Students for Revolution on the campus in the fall semester, we were threatened by racist groups on campus. NTFC was one of the first groups to issue a statement of support for us.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so
great.
Like I said, they've always been involved with different groups on campus, so when it was time for them to go through their struggle, you know, everybody came out to support them as well, and that's why we had so much power there with NTFC. And now they got this really amazing contract that I was going to just go through a couple of major points.
I want to bring one thing up. Is this sort of like them depending so much on non-tenure faculty is what gives a non-tenure faculty the power? It's a classic, like what Mark said, you know, you build the factory, you bring the workers together, and they can organize.
Exactly. Yeah. So the contract is a 5-year contract, which is very good. So it runs all the way through August 15, 2019. So some of the major provisions that, of course, that everybody was talking about, the biggest issue were multi-year contracts and also appointment reappointment. So what they were able to do is, the NTFC got their language into the contract of clear, consistent reappointment policies, which are informed about hiring for the fall by May 1st with July 1st as a fallback date. So that means that before the administration wanted to be very ambiguous so that they didn't have to assure reappointment for different groups so that they can lay off whenever they wanted to. With this language in the contract, they are very clear in that, no, you have to go through a certain protocol before you can do these things and lay people off. So they can't, it's actually almost impossible to not, to hurt the labor force now.
Okay.
Of the NTFC because they're, the language, see, that's the thing for those that are listening about how labor negotiations operate. Employers and bosses, I hate using that term because it's a very derogatory term. Employers, that's why I use. But they like to have language be very ambiguous.
Sure.
Because that way there's so many loopholes that when they can do stuff, there's you try to sue them or you try to call out Wagner Act, whatever, they can say, well, you can't really prove that because your contract says this and that, so I can interpret it either way. So what union people and working people try to do whenever they negotiate a contract is get clear language so there's a set of things happening, bam, 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 bam. And that's really what the fight was mainly about, was getting clear language in there so the administration can't just put a bunch of ambiguous stuff together and hurt workers, lay them off, fire them, whatever. And again, everybody keeps talking about wages as being something major, but wages was one of the last things that NTFC cared about because their main thing was making sure that their workers got support. They got support so that they won't have to worry about losing their jobs or being laid off. So again, the biggest thing was that they now have their language of clear, consistent reappointment policies that are informed by May 1st and July 1st as major dates to determine reappointment. You also have a governance policy where there's a 2-year window in which departments must alter bylaws to include NTTs in faculty and shared governance and must create clear evaluation systems. Now that's important because the problem with evaluations is that, you know, evaluations are very subjective. So what they're going to do is they're going to work within the faculty of the whatever department they're in to create the evaluation so that they can be fair. You know, the administration was pushing back against that before the strikes. So like I said, these are things that they got that are really powerful. The grievance procedure is another thing. And we, you know, especially you all, we have two laborers here. You all know that grievance procedures are made ambiguous and messy on purpose. And they make you go through a million steps so that by the time you get to a point, you're just like, I don't care anymore. Or you lose interest or you feel intimidated. No. They got a grievance procedure in place now to where it's only a couple of steps before they can take real serious action.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, that's important because, you know, I mean, there are tons of grievances that I know of personally that are going on that the person who's grieving doesn't want to do it anymore because they send them through so many loops because there's so many steps to it. They got a clear multi-tier grievance system in place now that makes the administration take accountability to whenever somebody has an issue. So that's very important. Yeah. That's really those are really the main things. Wages are in the contract as well. So there is steps to raises, etc. But that was just the back end. The biggest issue for NTFC that they wanted to get across was that they wanted to protect their workers so that they had jobs in the future. So reappointment, multi-year contracts, all that stuff is taken care of from the standpoint of having the language that the NTFC wanted and not what the administration wanted.
Okay. So up to this point, the university administration wanted basically a non-tenured labor ready, basically.
Yeah, pretty much. It's like Marx's theory of reserve labor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for those that aren't unfamiliar, you know, Marx argues that there is a working class, a section of the working class that is fired and hired based on the contraction and expansion of the economy. And they're considered the reserve army of labor. So that whenever the administration, let's put it in the context with the university, whenever the administration wants them, they can just have them there. And then when they want to fire them, they can just fire them, mm-hmm. just lay them off. Unemployment instability.
And lots of times they're not known about it until the last minute, so which exactly. hinders their ability to find employment elsewhere at some other university.
And that's why those dates are important that they have in the contract, mm-hmm. so that they're known. For instance, there's one thing in here that's very interesting that I forgot to mention about in terms of stability, that there has to be a window open to where somebody is told beforehand that there's going to be a possibility of them Even job. Yeah, so that's like you said, they have an opportunity to actually go out and search for work elsewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow, I tell you what, they've come a long way. I mean,
they did.
Gosh,
yeah.
I was just not two years ago when they were just talking about forming a union, and I was kind of skeptical if they were ever going to get anywhere, and then here we are, you know.
Well, you know what the big thing was is that the actual rank and file members are the ones who are running the union. They're the ones running the local.
Mm-hmm.
And again, so, like I said, if we really do a study of member-run locals or rank and file-run locals versus locals that hire somebody to come in and do work for them who have no relationship to the experiences of the workers or the people themselves, then there's a difference in the quality of the stuff they get done. So,
And like Local 703, though, you hire the company foreman or basically get them elected to positions where they are hired.
I know, that's the horrible thing about the building trades. That's what's devolved to. It didn't used to be that way, but, yeah, that's, there was a point I was going to make here, on that subject.
Well, I'll tell you what, Dave, we're running over a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll make it easy on Cheyampa's, programming schedule and, you know, go fade away.
Well,
we
want to talk about the Flint, crisis here.
Oh, okay.
Before we go. And I think Angela had some input on that too. So, you want me to start? Let's start with Angela. Angela, what have you been hearing lately from your friends and family about Flint?
We had feedback. Talked about that a while ago, but then my son and his friends, they're at the house a couple of days ago and they're like, he's like, Mom, the reason all those people were dying because they found like 20 bodies in that water. And I thought it was a lead thing, but if there's bodies and lead, yeah, people are gonna die.
Yeah, that's what I couldn't understand because, you know, lead poisoning takes a while, to kill somebody. I mean, it's something that's a very serious stuff, you know, but it's a long-term kind of thing. So I'm not quite sure what these bodies were they found. I mean,
It may be the fact that there are some, it depends on the dosage, because if you because there were children that had significant lead poisoning, and there was also mercury.
You combine mercury too. Yeah, oh, yes. So. Oh, man.
Yeah, but I mean, that just lets us know, okay, do you know how many bodies and, but they don't look at that type of stuff while they're spending money on all this other stuff. Why don't they drag these?
Yeah.
Drag this water and see what's in there and see what's going on here.
And fix it.
We don't know what's going on, but I heard that. I looked it up that the reason they're not doing anything because it costs so much money, you know, to do that whole underwater thing, especially the pipes and all of that, you know, they're rusty.
Yeah, it costs so much money compared to, let's see, $4 billion in military aid to Israel. I think it just got increased, actually.
Well, and at the same time, they get military aid to Egypt.
Yeah.
These things are bribes that were fought up, 20 years ago?
Yeah. But I mean, all this money that goes to, you know, foreign aid, it's not foreign aid to feed people, it's foreign military aid to bribery to foreign governments. You got tax breaks to these billionaires and corporations.
Going to all this unimportant stuff as to the things that are important. That's what the problem is. They're doing all this stuff. Okay, this doesn't make any sense. Okay, if it doesn't help the people in any type of way, then why is it happening?
Yeah, indeed. Well, yeah, and that's the thing is it's increasingly what this country's interest has been running is the interest of the very wealthy 1%. But don't worry, President Obama just arrived Wednesday in Flint, so everything's going to be great, right?
I think he drank a glass of water. I saw a picture of him with a glass of water.
Okay. Well, it seems like, President Obama's remarks Wednesday in Flint before an audience of about 1,000 people at Northwestern High School displayed, according to this writer, the arrogance and contempt of his administration and the corporate elite that it represents towards working people suffering from the devastating effects of lead in their drinking water. Flanked by a host of state and federal officials who oversaw the disaster in Flint, including the Environmental Protection Agency Chief Gina McCarthy and Michigan Governor Rick Snyder and Democratic congressmen and senators, the president offered a series of false promises and platitudes. He blandly noted certain symptoms of the social crisis in America, crumbling roads and bridges, aging water pipelines, failing public schools, without acknowledging the role his administration has presided over this disaster. pallets of bottled water standing a lot across the street from the venue of Obama's speech. In his trademark folksy and patronizing manner, Obama urged the people of Flint to resume drinking the city's water, despite test results showing the persistence of dangerous amounts of lead. At the same time, he dismissed the serious short and long-term effects of the poison of Flint children by lead-tainted water. It's quoted as saying, "The kids will be just fine," he said. To back up this assertion, Obama cited this spurious example of children accidentally chewing on lead flakes from paint. And also Obama urged Flint residents to begin drinking the water again, which in many areas is brown and still contains high levels of lead. And at one point in his remarks, he asked for and drank a glass of filtered water while proclaiming this is not a stunt. Unbelievable. Maybe this writer's a little biased here, you know, but I think, you know, there's a lot of facts here that... you know,
I didn't see any bias in that.
I'm just saying for those people, you know, there's, I mean.
Oh, who wrote it?
Oh, it's from the World Socialist website.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, as a matter of fact, I was going to ask you if that was where it was from because it sounded like them.
Okay.
I read it quite a bit.
But nevertheless, you look
but it's a good website and they have good ideas and they have.
But in essence, this is what happened. I mean, it's just this, Gus, you take it from here if you'd like or whoever.
You know, like I was saying earlier, you know, there's a festering skid mark that's following the president as he leaves office. I mean, just when you think that, okay, maybe it's possible he's got a year left, he's going to try to do something different and actually go back to some of
the real Obama.
Let
Obama be Obama.
Some of his community organizing roots that were around for a minute. You know, it's just that it's we continue to fool ourselves on him because, I mean, and what they did was some groups interviewed one of the people who has been organizing, and the young lady said, quote, "There is a difference there." And this is after Obama told them to drink the water.
Mm-hmm.
"There is a difference there between being around lead chips," because Obama made this ridiculous comparison to eating lead chips. Don't even get me started on that. "There's a difference between being around lead chips and realizing it and being around it long term. The long term side of not knowing you are being exposed from your water and for it to go on as long as it did." He was comparing apples to oranges, like comparing apples to a car. And her husband said it best, apples to toxic waste. "Our pipes had over 2.5 times the level of toxic waste coming into it. Because of the decisions made by the government, you're telling me our kids are going to be fine? No, our kids are not fine," end quote. And when they asked her about why he never, what she thought about him not mentioning just a dime of federal money to come in, quote, "That to me, that was a very low blow to the citizens. We were really hoping he declared Flint a federal disaster area."
That should have been done over a year ago.
Yeah, something that we argued on the show.
Yeah.
"That was the hope of the citizens throughout the city. For that to not happen was bad, but telling us our kids would be just fine, that was worse." So yeah, this is something that we talked about on this show, is that it should have been immediately designated as a federal disaster area. Should. And there should have been a total revamping of federal policies for the water in the city. And the fact that that wasn't done, I mean, there really should be national outcry. This should be just as big as the Katrina issue was.
Very good comparison.
I don't know how this is not as big as that.
You know what, but I already said, Gus, what it is we're overpopulating.
And so
they have to control the population. So, oh, okay, well, these people here die. Okay, that's less money they got to spend. Okay, give the family a couple hundred thousand so they can shut up. But they have to control it, because if it gets that big, then they're really not going to be able to do anything.
Well, I don't know if it really has much to do with population control, especially when Flint is not necessarily overpopulated as a space, and the U.S. is actually going through not necessarily a boom in terms of birth anymore as other parts of the world. I think it has more so to do with capital and the fact that these people don't matter to the sense that they don't deserve the water, you know, because there are other parts of the country that don't get water just like Flint. And the only reason they don't get it is because they're working class or poor. They're different color people.
60% of them is 60% black there as well. So I believe
it's more so about power than it is about the population control and killing.
And they want to basically rob the public tax monies to go to corporate interests. They don't want to spend any on the people or the infrastructure. More than they have to, you know.
It's about distribution of wealth. That's exactly where it is, because
that's what it's always
there's more than enough water to supply the peoples of the United States, let alone most of the world. That's changing, of course, because of issues in terms of our environment and things that the corporations are doing to the environment. But as of right now, there is water to take care of people, but very few people are getting safe water. So,
and yeah, and the ironic part is just 2 hours north of Flint, there is a Hershey's factory up there. They're not making chocolate. They're actually pumping out water. I mean, very good, clean water out of several wells up there and bottling it and selling it. And the state of Michigan has actually given Hershey's a tax credit to do this. Because it's providing, you know, a small amount of jobs, you know. And here they're only 2 hours away from an extremely good, clean source of water. And yet, instead of bringing it down in tanker trucks, they bring pallets of bottled water that they buy from these various water corporations, you know. I mean, this whole thing is just, I think, indicative of this whole neoliberal, you know, approach here in this country and then more and more throughout, you know, a lot of other parts of the world as well, you know. I mean, the whole thing, everything about it, you know. It's like, I think, you know, Chris Hedges wrote a book a couple of years ago called Sacrifice Zones. And in it, he basically described about how there's certain parts of the United States, and there's going to be more and more as time goes on, where basically they're just, you know, they're writing them off. Basically, they provide nothing useful to the ruling class, so they're just going to let them, you know, just deteriorate and fester.
I think that's exactly what it is that, yeah, they become blighted zones. These places that, of course, they look at the voter population, they don't matter. They look at the racial composition, they look at the income, they look at just different indicators to determine whether this is going to be a section that we ignore, you know. Because like I say, it's all about, do they contribute to our class interests? And if they don't contribute to the capital class interest, they're not engaging in consumerism to the level that we need. They don't have a certain population that we can exploit. You know, there's no industry there for us to exploit. Then we don't need them. And that's what the capitalist class is saying at this point.
Right. And long as they're taken care of and their families, you know, they could care less.
Oh, yeah. Indeed. Well, I've got some quick public service announcements here.
Oh, by the way, one announcement today is World Naked Gardening Day.
Oh.
So garden naked today.
Is that what you're going to do, Bill? Please don't take any video. Oh, okay. All right. Another sports show this Saturday and every Saturday from 2 to 3 with fellow worker Neil Parthen. It's at 104.5 WRFU from 2 to 3 today. And tomorrow and every Sunday is Labor's Worldview TV from 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6. And this coming Tuesday, May 10th, at the Independent Media Center, 202 South Broadway in Urbana, which is the downtown Urbana Post Office building, at 7 p.m., there's going to be a surprise announcement made in conjunction with the City of Urbana and an Independent Media Center concerning community and media organizing in Champaign, Urbana. So they're not telling us what that's going to be, but come out and check out what it might be. You know, it sounds interesting. So I think that's part of the allure here, is that they're keeping it a secret and letting people, you know, making them come out and find out what it is. So anyway, any last words or comments before we go?
I was just thinking about Nino Brown on New Jack City. He said, "Meanwhile, the rich get richer and the poor don't get a thing."
Congrats to the NTFC again. Like I said, if you know of them or you just want to send out support, make sure you hit them up on Facebook or on Twitter. Non-tenure track faculty, local 6546. That solidarity really means a lot, and that win is going to do so much for this city and for the state of Illinois moving forward with Rauner. I'm telling you, this is going to be big, because labor militancy is infectious.
Well, let's hope so. And we're going to go out on that note. Thank you for tuning in to the World Labor Hour. You're going to be listening to some Tom Morello, which is the song Uniontown. And until next week, we'll be back on tuning in to the World Labor Hour. And until then, be safe and power the people. Take care.
Memories are forever, send the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walks up and said, "This is a union town, a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if you
come to strip our rights away. We'll give you hell every time. This is a union town, a union town, all down the line. Today the policeman's a union man, brother firefighter's my friend. And the kids locked in the Capitol are fighting till the end. And we're not gonna break tonight, and we're not gonna bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around, and everybody said, this is a union town, a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, a union town, all down the line. And if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a union town, a union town, all down the line.